Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Matt Holbrook, the University of Birmingham, about his new book, Prince of Tricksters, The Incredible True Story of Netley Lucas, Gentleman Crook. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking with Matt Holbrook, who is a professor of cultural history at the University of Birmingham, about his fascinating new book, The Prince of Tricksters, The Incredible True Story of Netley Lucas, Gentleman Crook, which was published this year by University of Chicago Press. And it's an incredible work, really. It's a theoretical book. It's a fascinating tale about a really interesting character, and also it's quite a personal book as well. So I'm delighted to have Matt on the pod.
Thanks, Dave. It's good to be here. Good to be talking to you.
So I think we might start by introducing the book a little in context. So one of the things about the book is that it took you a long time to write, and it's part of a much broader sort of research agenda that you've got on the 20s and 30s. So I wonder if you could kind of situate the book within this kind of broader research agenda.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I got into the book. I didn't mean to write a book about one man, and I certainly didn't mean to write a book about a confidence trickster. I just became interested about 10 years ago in trying to make sense of British culture in the decades after the Great War, and to try and work out the unlikely ways in which cultural life was disrupted or reshaped or rethought in the aftermath. And I spent a long time casting around for ways into thinking about this. I knew I didn't want to write a conventional book about the memory of the Great War. And then I slowly began to hone in on, I suppose, these quintessential figures of the 1920s who moved between different lives and different identities. And it started to strike me that these were the kind of figures that you could use to say something about a culture that was increasingly dislocated, disrupted, that contained all kinds of new possibilities for remaking and self-making. And eventually that turned into a book, the book that became Prince of Tricksters. I started off looking at a range of different characters of vamps, confidence tricksters, shysters. And then this one character, the character I ended up writing about, just came to focus a lot more clearly. And so I began to pursue them in a more serious, more systematic way.
This might sound like a strange question, but how do you actually do research about a confidence trickster? Over the course of the book, our character, who we might call Netley Lucas, but also he has several names, he gets involved in a whole range of different activities. And in some ways, these names kind of reflect, as you say, a different kind of self that he makes. This is at the same time against the background of journalism, publishing official records in things like courts, and the kind of the records that the state keeps. So how do you actually kind of write the history of almost someone who doesn't want to be represented?
I'm still not sure I can answer that question. 10 years on. It's difficult because Lucas moves through so many different names. The man, 40 different names I've seen him, I think I've seen him in the period between his birth in 1903 and his death in 1940. And the fact that he changes names constantly frustrates all the normal research tools that we use as a historian. It's no longer straightforward to tap a name into an online database of newspapers or of shipping records because you're never quite sure who you're looking for. So there's a lot of trial and error, a lot of trying out different names, and there's just a hell of a lot of luck stumbling across the copy of one of his criminal confessions on eBay that then has a later newspaper report pasted inside the front cover that some reader has collected together. And I suppose the other interesting challenge is you just said that his lives move between these very, very different phases. So he had a spectacular short-lived spell as a confidence trickster. He was an incredibly prolific confessing ex-crook and crime writer. And then he was a royal biographer. And I suppose through each of those stages, constantly found myself moving into historical terrain that I wasn't really familiar with or comfortable with. And a lot of the process of making sense of Lucas was about coming in sideways, coming in through the social world, the cultural world, the professional world that he was inhabiting. So finding a trace of him in a news agency, a literary agency in the late 1920s, and then sort of scurrying outwards and trying to make sense of histories of literary agency, histories of news agency in that period.
Yeah, I mean, the book does that wonderfully well, actually, that kind of task of situating him. And I think that's one of the things that we're going to get into over the course of discussing the book, actually, is the kind of not just the context of the 20s, but also the context of the particular worlds he moves in as both criminal, journalist, biographer. But before that, I think we should probably talk a little bit about him as much as we can do, given his multiple aliases and his kind of several different selves. So who was Netley Lucas? You know, what can we say to introduce him before turning to his story, which is very much the story of the 1920s and 30s?
Who was Netley Lucas? Yeah, someone should write a book about that. It took me 10 years to write this book, and I'm still not sure I figured that question out. I mean, what different stories can you tell? He's a flamboyant, larger-than-life trickster who lives fast and dies young, who dies in 1940, a washed-up alcoholic in a fire that he starts. He's born into a kind of privileged family in 1903. His grandfather is a stockbroker. But he's also born into a family that's profoundly dislocated. His father is a really kind of hedonistic alcoholic actor. His mother dies in childbirth. And so by 1907, when, as the story goes, Netley's father is murdered in Paris, he's effectively orphaned. And so there's a story that he tells himself about how he makes good from these tragic beginnings. But he tells the opposite story as well, that he was born into a life of privilege, and his story, as he presents it, is of opportunity squandered rather than a life remade.
That's interesting because that sort of scratches the surface of him, doesn't it? I'm just thinking, like, you know, you joked about someone should write a book, but the book is so kind of wonderful on, you know, even that tale that you've told there, the book makes clear that might be true, but it might not as well. It's really kind of interesting. And particularly the moments where the stories he's told collide with some sense of official records or, you know, the official version of reality. And before we turn to that, though, I think we should have a think. If Lucas is kind of one side of the book, I suppose the period is the other. And one of the comments you make quite early on in the book is the sense that the 1920s deserved a character like Lucas. And you've gestured towards the kind of social changes going on at the time. But I wonder if you could sketch out the sort of, what do you call them, the deep-rooted anxieties and the social context that allow the trickster to flourish.
Yeah, of course. It's tempting with a flamboyant trickster, someone who's larger in life in the way that Lucas is, to see them as somehow extraordinary. And because they're extraordinary, they're exceptional and they're unrepresentative. But I think one of the things that I wanted to do in the book was to place this confidence trickster, this man who shifts identities, very, very firmly in the everyday social worlds, the cultural worlds that he inhabited. So this is a period in which it's widely understood that the effects of the Great War have been to destabilize the boundaries between social classes, between genders, between races and ethnicities. And there's all kinds of anxieties about the implications that has for social order. That kind of then sits alongside, I think, the growing traces of a consumer culture that we, I suppose, are familiar with today, a consumer culture defined by advertising, by fashion, by cinema, that sells the kind of the prospect of personal reinvention. You know, you use this makeup and you can be as glorious as Theda Bara, for example. And I think what you then get is an everyday social world, an everyday culture that places increasing emphasis on front and facade as defining who you are. And in that world, the confidence trickster isn't an exceptional figure, they're an exemplary figure because everyone's acting. The only difference is that people like Netley Lucas are doing it more spectacularly, more overtly, perhaps more flamboyantly than everyone else. So there's this kind of concern in the 1920s and 1930s that it's increasingly difficult to know an individual's place in society. And that becomes a threat to ideas about social order, ideas about cultural taste, ideas about political life.
At the same time, one of the things that you bring up through the story of I guess, kind of, you know, Netley being caught and exposed as a confidence trickster is the sense that this was also a period where people were, you know, kind of almost sort of more aware of the possibility of the confidence trickster precisely because of that kind of broader social anxiety. And by the end of the 20s, the kind of, maybe it's not a moral panic per se, but, you know, that kind of concern has gone. So I wonder if you could talk me through the kind of the moment where Netley stops being confidence trickster in the traditional sense when he gets caught, and how this points us towards a sort of decline in the fear and panic over confidence tricks by the 30s.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that happens, we can all identify confidence tricks for some other times and other places. It's a kind of perennial deception, a perennial form of acting. But there's this kind of perception in the 1920s that there's something unique about the confidence trick, or that the confidence trick is uniquely prominent. Detective Inspector Percy Smith refers to this as the confidence tricks as palmy days. And there's a number of different things that seem to be going on here. One is that this disrupted world after the Great War creates more opportunities for particular kinds of deception. So Netley Lucas masquerading as a gentleman crook by acquiring a ready-to-wear smart suit in London's West End. But there's also a fixation with an anxiety about the confidence trickster on the part of the popular press, but also in particular Metropolitan Police. So this plays out in the formation of what Percy Smith describes as a confidence squad, a particular branch of the Metropolitan Police. It's all about catching the confidence trickster. But because you've got police officers deliberately targeting the confidence trick, that means that they apprehend more tricksters. That means that more of these cases are reported in newspapers like the News of the World or the Empire News, and that gives the trick that kind of prominence. So when Netley Lucas is arrested for his most flamboyant fraud, when he poses as Lord Lucas and rips off colonial outfitters in central London in 1920, the case is all over the newspapers. It's reported across the broadsheets in popular press. And it's both this excited, breathless story about an audacious crook, but also it carries with it in it was like Sunday People, it carries with it a degree of reassurance that no matter how successfully someone masquerades for a short period of time, eventually they will be put in their place. That is there to the same extent by the end of the 1930s. And I think a number of things have happened. One is that sense of disruption that characterizes the aftermath of the Great War has stabilized. So the aftermath of the Great War is a period of industrial dispute, race riots, profound anxieties about class relations and the future of British social, cultural, political life. Those tensions have settled down, have calmed down by the late 1920s, early 1930s. And alongside that, there's a growing confidence on the part of the Metropolitan Police that they've finally got this problem in check. So the confidence squad, the register of confidence strictures, these things are actually working, and they're more confident. People like Percy Smith are more confident than managing people like Netley Lucas.
His career then sort of takes advantage of that heightened media interest, and he switches to be to have a kind of journalistic and literary career, as you mentioned, as a sort of insider in the underworld telling stories of crime. Some of this is framed through a kind of redemption narrative. You know, he served his time, and now, precisely as you mentioned, you know, he's back within the social order that has settled down. But also it tells us about, you know, a kind of profound transformation in British media culture. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about his literary and journalistic career, and obviously kind of, you know, contextualize that with changes in journalism and publishing.
Yeah, of course. Around about 1923, 24, Netley Lucas is both remade by the popular press and also remakes his life through it. So he's already got a degree of prominence because newspapers have reported his high-profile arrests in 1920 and 1923 and 1924. And what he begins to do around about 1923 is capitalize on the growing interest in crime, and in particular first-hand stories about the criminal underworld amongst newspapers like the News of the World or John Bull or the Sunday People. So like many other criminals in this period, he sells what is ostensibly his true life story. We might kind of think quite carefully about whether there is any truth in the stories that he sells. He sells his story to the highest bidder. So he begins selling his confessions of his life in the underworld of London, of New York, and Chicago to a series of Sunday newspapers. That's not necessarily anything unusual in the mid-1920s. As the newspaper circulation wars hot up, crime becomes a kind of key battlefield in the competition for circulation, the competition for readership. So newspapers like Reynolds or the News of the World are always on the hunt for big, exclusive, breaking crime stories. Lucas sells his story in the same way as adventurers like Josephine Adair or a whole range of criminals sell their stories. What becomes, I think what's different about Lucas is that he has the energy, that he has maybe the education, the social and cultural capital to go one step beyond this. So he moves from confessing in newspapers, first of all, to publishing these confessions in book form. So taking advantage of the connections that he forges with popular publishers. But the next step after that, something that happens about around about 1925, 1926, 1927, is that he starts writing about crime in a different register. So rather than being simply a confessing ex-crook himself, someone who's calling on his personal experience of the underworlds of Paris or London to write about crime, he reinvents himself as a crime reporter. So he's still claiming this specialist knowledge, and we can see this move as part of the professionalization of journalism in the mid-1920s. But his professional knowledge is that of an objective, skilled, meticulous reporter. So he works for the Sunday News, 1926, 1927, writing not about his own crimes, but those of others. about the practice of criminal investigation, about the use of fingerprinting to identify criminals. And then eventually this culminates when, no longer content to talk about himself as a crime reporter, he redefines himself as a criminologist, publishes in the popular press under the byline as a criminologist, and eventually sets up a short-lived but interesting journal called The Criminologist in 1927. So you can see the phases that he goes through, which increasingly remove him from the everyday criminal confessions that characterize the popular press. Each of these steps tells us something about the nature of the mass media in 1920s Britain.
But he's eventually discredited. And how does this happen?
Well, the interesting thing about Lucas is that he's a prolific writer. So he publishes 5 or 6 books under his own name about crime and any number of newspaper and magazine articles in things like the Railway Review, right through to Granta, the Cambridge University Literary Journal. So he can clearly write, and he's clearly incredibly industrious. But the striking thing, one story that you could tell about him, he's never quite content. That whatever success he has is never quite enough. And in 1927 and 1928, he's basically found out for faking exclusive stories on some very, very high-profile murder cases in his reports for the Sunday News. And he's exposed, first of all, he's exposed implicitly by journalists from Sunday People, although he's not named in those reports. But then eventually there's a really high-profile report in the weekly newspaper John Bull, which exposes him for making up a story about the successful resolution of an old murder case. And it ruins him, in effect, because he's increasingly come to base his personal reputation, his claim to credibility, on knowledge, authority, objectivity, and truth. But all of a sudden, that's revealed as a shoddy fake. And he's completely discredited. So the career that he's built up in Fleet Street as a criminologist and a crime writer, shatters. What he does is interesting. He moves to New York at that point in the winter of 1927-1928, and is involved in this incredibly spectacular, international flurry of publicity, where he fakes an engagement to Chicago Mayor Churchill, who's one of the most famous, most notorious, perhaps, I suppose you'd think about her as a gangster's mole in Prohibition-era America. And Chicago May and Lucas, they share a publisher. They work with Doubleday and Duran in New York. And they basically fake their engagement in order to sell their respective books. And this is reported all over the world because it's a good story, but also because it's an unlikely romance. I mean, May is then in her 60s. Lucas is in his mid-20s. But what that does, again, is discrediting, because journalists from the New York Times start looking very, very carefully about the crime writings of this audacious young English criminologist. And what they increasingly show is that, or what they increasingly argue, is that confessions that he's claimed are about his own experiences of crime are actually fake. And so at this moment of maybe his greatest international celebrity, Lucas is discredited again. And forced to do a runner from New York, head back to London in January 1928, and then eventually take yet another new name and start a new phase of his career.
Yeah, this is where Mr. Graham enters the story as a biographer of essentially kind of royalty and the social elites, which had, I suppose, a different set of concerns associated with it, but similar kinds of boundary policing that essentially leads to another kind of discrediting and another kind of exposure and scandal. So what was the sort of the bogus biography factory he was involved with, particularly in terms of the commodification of the social elites that he claimed to know?
One of the things that seems to characterize Lucas is that he's really attuned to, he's really attuned to, I suppose, what we might think of as market demand in publishing and the press. So when he moves back to London in 1928, he picks up on the growing demand for royal biographies, not just necessarily the conventional royal biography that is interested in public life, ceremony, pomp, and circumstance, but a new kind of royal biography that's interested in the realms of the private, domestic life, emotions, family, and so on and so forth. And so he becomes a prolific royal biographer and publisher, moving between different names. Usually he's known as Ethan Graham, the biographer, but he also works as the publisher, Albert E. Marriott, and sometimes under the name Richard Dent, Charlotte Cavendish, all of these different names. And it's hard to tell him exactly what he does, but as far as I know, as far as I can tell, he publishes something like something between 15 or 20 biographies of British and European royalty under his own name, and then any number of other royal biographies as the publisher, Albert E. Marriott. And the way he goes about doing this is really, really interesting. So royal biography sells. Intimate stories of royal lives and royal families sell in this period. Graham, although he could just make a lot of this stuff up, goes to extraordinary lengths to secure the approval of the royal household, the courtiers associated with King George V, Queen Mary, the Prince of Wales, later to become Edward VIII. So you can track how he goes about writing these books, and you can track how he tries to secure the status of an authorised biography for his work through the archives that are collected, that he's produced in the Royal Archives in Windsor Castle. And you can track here the correspondence that he has with courtiers, where he approaches them asking if they'll read his work or if they'll approve or authorise his life of the Prince of Wales. You can then see the way they respond to this, sometimes working very, very closely with him to correct his errors, at other times basically telling him where to go, and particularly the courtiers associated with King George V are very reluctant to get involved with this upstart parvenu biographer who they never heard of and who can't call upon the connections of class and club and military service that most other royal biographers can evoke in this period. And what happens between 1928 and 1931 is that the relationship between Evelyn Graham or Albert Marriott and the royal household deteriorates. The royal household are increasingly aware that this is something different, and they become more and more exercised by publication of biographies in print and in newspapers that are explicitly or clearly fake, are both unwanted and are somehow duplicitous. So there's a war diary of the Prince of Wales, what's presented as a life of King George V by a gentleman of England. And in both of these cases, Evelyn Graham, the royal biographer, becomes the subject of literary scandal, front page news, when, as far as I can tell, what seems to happen is that courtiers leak the news that these are unwelcome biographies to journalists working for particular newspapers, the Star or the Morning Star or the Express, for example, Morning Post or the Express, for example. So there are a series of scandals around the bogus biography factory that culminate in 1931, when finally the Daily Mail gets interested in Evelyn Graham and exposes him as a shoddy fake. But not just a shoddy fake, but as the former confidence trickster, Netley Lucas. And there's this great moment where Lucas realizes that Daily Mail is onto him and goes on the run. It goes on the run down through continental Europe, through the Suez Canal, and then eventually ends up in Durban over the Christmas of 1930, tracked every single step of the way by the Daily Mail. Eventually this scandal dries out, and Graham Lucas returns to London in 1931, but he's been discredited again, his companies have gone bankrupt, and he's run out of money. So his final flurry is when he tries to sell a biography of Queen Alexandra that's ostensibly written by one of her ladies-in-waiting. Journalists really, really quickly pick up on this. It's exposed as a fake. He's forged a letter that's ostensibly written by Lord Stamfordham, George V's private secretary, and then is arrested for attempting to obtain money by false pretenses. The case comes to court in July 1931, September 1931, and it's this moment of the public humiliation, the public exposure of probably one of the most famous royal biographer of the early 1930s. The most famous royal biographer of the early 1930s is revealed to be a confidence trickster who's conning the British reading public.
And this is bound up with, as you talk about in the book, you know, the kind of reassertions of class boundaries, the, you know, that sense you mentioned earlier of the kind of the return to order at the end of a very, you know, kind of uncertain and fluid time in British society. And you get the sense from the press coverage that you talk about that there is a kind of a sense of both, you know, we have to stop this terrible middle brow interest in elites, whilst at the same time we have to kind of reassert the social order.
Yeah, he's an upstart.
Yeah.
He's not from the class, but not from the class of people that should be writing royal biographies.
Yeah.
But there's also a politics to this as well, Dave, but this is a moment, the moment of his discrediting is about the royal household taking back control of the representation of the British monarchy. So they are deeply invested in creating a positive image for King George V, Queen Mary, the Prince of Wales. And they do that by working very, very closely with key biographers. But Evelyn Graham, Albert Marriott, they're not playing the game. They're kind of doing something that the royal household doesn't like. And so one of the things that's happening behind the scenes in 1939-31 is that courtiers are pulling the strings and are mobilising publishers, editors, literary agents to shut down the bogus biography factory. So there's kind of an interesting thing going on here, which is about, it's about politics, it's about power, it's about elites sort of securing authority over the representation of the monarchy.
So our hero, if I can call him that, comes out of prison and there's both, I mean, there's two things in the kind of later sections of the book. One, there's the sense of he never really makes it again. There's, you know, attempts to kind of get back involved with particular social elites who are very, like, quickly onto him and, you know, kind of close down things. You know, there's correspondence you draw on about, no, we know who this character is. We don't want him involved in things. There's also an attempt to involve Churchill in some writing. It's, you know, it's kind of fascinating from the point of view of seeing someone on the edge of high society at the time. But then at the same time, there's a challenge as a historian to kind of tell the later life story of someone who, because they're not able to pull their confidence tricks off in whatever setting, present you with a challenge of where are the records, you know, how do we know about him? You write really kind of interestingly about his funeral and the kind of the sense of, you know, who was there? Did they turn up? What would it have been like to come to a funeral for someone who had, you know, so many aliases and this sort of thing? So I wonder if you could say a little bit about that sense of not just his life after prison, but also the challenge as a historian trying to piece that together.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the period between when he comes out of prison in 1933 and then when he dies in July 1940, in a way, that's when he's always elusive. He's always kind of a flicker in the archive, a flicker in a newspaper report, a name on a piece of headed notepaper that might be the person that you're looking for. And that's true. That's true throughout his life. It becomes particularly acute in the 1930s because there's this overriding kind of sense of melancholy that this is a life that's sort of that's limping to an end, that's fizzling out in many ways. So you see him in flashes, a mention in a divorce file, a kind of a brief comment in a scribbled annotation by a courtier. And I think, you know, the usual response of a historian or a biographer to challenges like this is is to try and read through the gaps, to try to treat the gaps, to treat the silences as a kind of problem to overcome. And, you know, that's great. And there's a lot of good work that does that kind of thing, that treats an individual life as a puzzle to solve. But I didn't really want to do something like that, because it seemed to me that it didn't reflect the nature of Netley Lucas's lives and lives, but also that it didn't do justice, that it wasn't really it wasn't a satisfying way of writing history. I think one of the things that I really, the book is about him, the book is about working on a conference trip, so he's constantly changing shape, but it's also an extended reflection or a mediation on how we might write history differently. And I think what I wanted to do was to leave the stories that I could tell about Lucas or Graham or Marriott open-ended, to show, to be content to show what might have been, to be content to show other possibilities, other ways of reading the fragments, to kind of produce a sort of history, I guess, that was more uncertain, that accepted the gaps in our knowledge on their own terms, but didn't try to fill them, but worked with the gaps, worked with the silences as a way of, I suppose, as a way of reflecting on what history is, how we might do it differently.
In that kind of light, I mean, you said, you know, the book is about him, but it's also about history itself. I mean, how do you sort of feel about him? Which sounds like a strange question, but, you know, as a professional project, it's taken, you know, you've sunk a lot of work into it. There's a lot of, you know, kind of theoretical or historiographical reflection, but it's about this guy, you know, it's a story of this confidence trickster. So I'm kind of interested to hear sort of like how you actually feel about him.
He's quite, I mean, you know, the book opens with me writing a love letter to him to try and make sense of exactly why I became obsessed with him, and obsessed with him to the point that I chased him across archives and libraries for 10 years. And then the book kind of closes with, I suppose, what you'd call a breakup letter, when it's this moment when I've just become, when I just was absolutely kind of fed up with his tricks, his deceptions, his lies. And how I feel about him is somewhere in between those things. He's beguiling, charming, audacious. He draws you in to keep wanting to know more. And I think all of that, the nature of his deceptions, his constant movement between different lives and different stories, has been incredibly productive for me, because it's been on that basis that I've tried to find a way of writing about the past that echoes those uncertainties. But also, you know, he's not a nice man. He's a crook. He's duplicitous. He betrays all of the people who become closest to him. He has two wives, countless affairs. He is in a long-term relationship with his pal and with his pal and partner, Guy Hart or Albert Marriott. He later is a violent, misogynistic, washed-up alcoholic. He's not a nice guy. And so there's something, in a way, becoming beguiled by someone like this, writing a book about someone like this, that's quite an uncomfortable experience for me, to become obsessed with him, because you know, he's not pleasant in lots of ways. But he's been incredibly productive of the ways that I have started to think about both Britain in the 20s and 30s, about nature of history, about my own practice as a historian.
So where are you kind of taking this next? Obviously, you know, the story of this Prince of Tricksters is to an extent closed by the book, but obviously the kind of themes you brought up, I guess, extend into your current work as well.
Yeah. Right now I'm trying to resist the temptation to write another book about an extraordinary individual. I find, you know, it's a way of working that I've become increasingly comfortable with, that increasingly familiar with me. Like you find someone intriguing in a newspaper report, and then you sort of begin to tease out, you begin to pursue the different threads of their life. I don't want to be a one-trick historian, though, so I'm trying to resist that at the moment, although I'm sure I'll end up doing something similar. I suppose right now I've taken a bit of a step back, and I'm trying to finish this book, trying to finish a book about that reflects on the nature of British culture in the 1920s in the round, that takes a lot of the pieces, a lot of the themes that have been present or implicit in my work on Lucas, and just looks at them in a wider possible sense. So I'm interested in what happens to cultural life in the 1920s in the aftermath of war, but also in particular in how in the significance of the 1920s for the making of modern British culture. Because I think it increasingly seems to me that this is a formative moment in the making of modern Britain, but it's one that we've lost sight of. We've lost sight of it because it's bracketed by the Great War and the Second World War, these supposedly more important events that come before and after. We've lost sight of it because the British experience of the 1920s seems less dramatic, less spectacular than that of continental Europe or the United States. We've lost sight of the significance of the 1920s, the radicalness of the 1920s, under these comforting notions of the long weekend or the jazz age or the roaring 20s. And, you know, they're really evocative terms, and they're terms that carry our interest in the decade after the Great War. But they don't do justice to the freighted nature of this moment in British cultural life. It's a moment when, in effect, a lot of modern British culture is up for grabs in the process of becoming. And so I want to write a book that takes all of those themes, brings them together, and suggests something different about how we might think about the place of the 1920s in modern British history.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I was talking to Professor Matt Holbrook from the University of Birmingham about his new book, Prince of Tricksters, which was published by the University of Chicago.